Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Garland Pepper Presents podcast. Today, my guest is Dr. Duncan Cowber. And Duncan and I have been friends long before he was actually a doctor. He was working on it, I believe, when we first met, but I met him more in the rock and roll world. And Duncan is a loyal friend and a kind and generous man. And we've always gotten along quite well. Our last interview, he had just graduated with honors, I believe, from with a doctorate in psychology. So just emerging into that world. And so this is this conversation today, I think, is where I'd like to see us go today, is first off, you know, catching up with what that world has taught Duncan in the last couple years almost. I think it is our 2-year anniversary of having our first conversation. And also, just the state of psychology, I believe, on a meta scale. I think we have that conversation in us also today. So, state of psychology in it as it pertains to the well-being of even our nation. So, it's an interesting conversation that we're going to have today. I'm very grateful that you're here today. Please subscribe to Garland Pepper Presents podcast on whatever listening device you have. If you feel generous and would like to support the program, there is a support button. Feel free to do so. This it's a labor of love. Takes a bit of time, bit of energy, and a lot of focus to do. And so if you want to support that, I would love it. Thank you very much. And have a beautiful day. Now, welcome to my guest, Duncan Cowber. Duncan, how are you today?
Yeah, I'm doing pretty well. Sunday, I love Sundays. I don't do anything on Sunday except just relax. And so I think it was a great day to schedule the interview. I really appreciate you having me back, Gary. Really enjoyed what you've been doing, and it's great to be a part of it. So yeah, 2 years since we last talked, huh? How time flies during a pandemic.
Yeah, yeah, it does. It has, well, it's just been weird. So the pandemic itself is this bizarre reality that we got to live. And I say we got to live because there were opportunities as well as disaster within it. And for me, the great opportunity was time, and the disaster was losing my job. Right. So where did you, what were your opportunities and disasters from that period of time? Well, I know of one opportunity that presented itself and really blossomed. And you were actually coming into the blossoming of all opportunities that you had been working for, that you'd been tilling the earth for.
Yeah, I guess that would be a really great way to say it. I mean, graduate school is probably, well, it's a great example of delayed gratification and enduring suffering for something that is really far off in the distance. And that doesn't really promise any great immediate rewards, right? Because even when you graduate with a doctoral degree in a clinical field like this, there's a lot of time that it takes before your practice, at least for me, I'm in private practice, before it really kind of takes shape as to what you've been envisioning throughout those 6 or 7 years of graduate school. So yeah, there was a lot of hard work. And a lot of times when I really wasn't sure if I was going to get through that work. Some real dark nights of the soul, as Carl Jung would call them, where you're questioning yourself, you're questioning your abilities, you're questioning even the point of what you're doing. And you just have to keep putting one foot in front of the other to accomplish the goal. I mean, at some point you realize, well, if I don't complete this goal, here I'm going to be stuck with like $500,000 in debt and nothing to do to pay it back, right?
Right.
So you almost feel like an indentured servant at some point. But, you know, it's a very fulfilling field. And I'm very glad to be a part of it. So yeah, accomplishments and opportunities and trials and tribulations are all part of what we've been going through this last 2 years. So many people did lose their jobs during the pandemic, including you. And so it's been a really difficult time for a lot of people, I think majority of the country in that way. I guess I have been kind of simultaneously fortunate, but also a challenge, because the field of psychology has experienced a greater demand for services than probably at any other time in the last decade. So yeah, our job has been very stable, but the things that we've been working on with people, at least in, you know, the therapy sessions that I do, very much reflected the turmoil that our country is going through and the despair, honestly, that people feel not only about their own status, their ability to provide for their families, but also their willingness or like, you know, to contribute to the culture that they live in because everybody's in self-protect mode. And so we've experienced probably a really big stagnation of growth in our country. And so, yeah, I've been working a lot with people in therapy sessions as to how to kind of get themselves back so that they can feel like they're living their life, as you were saying.
So what's that self-protect mode look like? Like how do people, what does that behavior look like?
So there's a couple of ideas that come to mind for me on that one. So the one that comes up immediately for me is the self-protect mode of dividing ourselves into polar opposites in terms of cultural affiliations or political affiliations, to where we've really lost the ability to listen to the other side and try to see where they're coming from. That I think is a self-protect mode because if we surround ourselves with people who agree with us in an extreme way, then it really makes it easy to identify friend versus foe.
Yeah.
And so this is a, I think, example of the unconscious fight or flight that our population is going through. So I think another thing that we see the self-protect is like just even on an individual level where we have this different approach that we see on facing the pandemic. So we've got on one hand, people who believe, you know, we've got to protect ourselves with appropriate medical measures like vaccines and masking and social distancing. And then we have the other side, which is more interested in self-protection in terms of their personal freedoms and liberties, to where they see the idea of vaccine mandates or mask mandates as an infringement on their freedom. So both groups are trying to protect their own interests, but they have a different locus or you know, orientation toward what they're protecting. On one hand, we've got a group trying to protect the social good. And then on the other hand, we have a group trying to protect the individual rights. Both have validity in my mind, but what I really am drawing out here is this idea that they're totally separated into extreme poles at this point, and they're not having an easy time understanding each other's motivations.
So, I mean, even the policy differences are self-keeping, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, I want to keep my rights to be free and I don't want government infringement on me. And then the other ones are like, well, why can't you just get on board and we'll all be safer?
Mm-hmm.
Right. So both of them are coming from like a different point of the same view. Like it is about safekeeping. I want to keep my rights versus I want to keep my health. In a sense was the argument. And, you know, it's interesting that it seems very different than the country I grew up in and was promised, you know, and that mm-hmm. was a country of neighbors.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we didn't talk politics, we didn't talk religion, and apparently there's a reason for that. And maybe they got to that point in the past and we're like, hey, there's just those two, yes, they don't get you anywhere. but it seems to me that those became the dominant conversations. And what happened is people started to realize that, well, I think differently than you about this. And I didn't even know that. Or mm-hmm. I think differently than you about this. And I used to be okay with that. But now they're telling me that you're actually bad, that your ideas make you bad. And so now we've got this kind of making enemies of a class or group of people. Mm-hmm. Based upon that fear of mm-hmm. ideas.
Yeah, absolutely. It's interesting when you said you were raised believing that you lived in a country of neighbors. I think what we really see now is a country of enemies. And they do come down to these things that tend to be just, you know, ideological. They're not practical matters. They're ideological.
No, most of the things people are very angry about have very little influence on their actual day-to-day lives. I mean, actually very little practical influence except for all the energy they're given it.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. And rather than trying to seek to understand difference through discourse, we see both sides shutting down discourse and dissent within their own ranks. And again, that has to do with the self-protection of that group identity, but it just deepens this divide. If we can't listen to the other side and we see them as other and we see them as evil or bad, you know, communist or fascist, these are all labels that we use to identify groups in large swaths. And for example, I mean, I count myself as a centrist leaning left, and I work in a community that is probably more or less right leaning, a small industrial town in Southwest Washington. And so I work with people who a lot of my peers would never dream of talking to, people who support a certain president, a past president, or, you know, people who are against the vaccine or against mask mandates and things like that. And so I guess I have an opportunity, we talk about opportunities, to have a discourse with those folks and try to see where they're coming from in an effort to help them be okay too. And it wouldn't be very good for me to proselytize to them, you know, a great deal about political or social differences, because the point that I'm trying to provide is, you know, care. And so it's an interesting position to be in when you see a lot of your peers really holding firm on some ideological beliefs about the other side to where they just won't engage with them. And yet here I am actively engaging with what I think a lot of my friends would call the other side.
Yeah, yeah. And what have you learned from them?
Just like us.
Yeah, right? The same stuff. And it's weird how this identity that we, you know, we're so taught, and I think it has a lot to do with just marketing in general and how we are just bombarded with it in our lives. But we're just taught to have these ideas of ourself that are all packaged up, you know, and then if you go against my packaging, then you're going against me. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's like, I guess a good simile for this would be teams, team sports, team jersey. You know, you got your full on, we're all red today, they're all green today. Uh-oh, something happened in the parking lot because we disagreed on which team was better.
Right, yeah.
It's all you teams. Know? Yeah. Yeah, and it's really, there is this team mentality that is my team. I am on the team. Therefore, I support everything the team says, beliefs, does. Mm-hmm. And all of my friends are going to be team supporters because that's who I like to hang out with. And then, you know, what you end up with is very much a little stovepiped world, you know, your whole world is just this thing. And then it's so easy to do nowadays. It's so much easier than it used to be. We all had a shared experience through the five channels of TV or four or three, you know, we all had that shared experience. And now people can pick their affinity and go anywhere else and put on their costume. This is my team. And now here you go. And you can be offended at everybody who doesn't like your team.
Yeah, it becomes very personal. Are you on my team or not?
Right.
So one of the other things I thought about, though, because I said, yeah, we're all the same. But actually, there is one thing that really stands out for me as I reflect on that, about how we actually might be different. And this is born out, this is seen in psychological research. The idea that people who tend to lean liberal or are liberal are more open to new experiences and do not react with the same level of fear to things that are different than what they expect. And people who lean more conservative tend to react with more fear and self-protection to unknown and difference and change. I mean, that's kind of obvious in the way that we delineate those two sides, right? Conservatives want everything to stay the way it is or the way it even used to be. And liberals want to keep pushing forward with new ideas and experiences and acceptance. So I think that is one thing I would notice because, yeah, I have worked with a couple of people who are just unwilling to endorse things like supporting trans kids or gay marriage. You know, they're very locked into the belief that those things have some sort of like, I don't know, like there's something wrong with those things. Whereas the side that I more lean to and affiliate with would say, no, like everybody deserves dignity and care and recognition for who they are as a person. And if that means I have to change or somebody else has to change their assumptions about what those people are like in order to adopt love for them, then I'm open to that. I want to learn how to do that. And I think the United States was essentially founded by two different types of groups. I think it comes down to like one group moved here, the New World, because they wanted to transplant their way of living that was being, you know, maybe persecuted or just not, the rest of their culture didn't want to be as like specific about that lifestyle they did. So they were like, well, we got to leave all these pagans or these, you know, heretics and do our own Puritan colony in the United States where we can't be disturbed and we can keep everything pure. Right. And then you had another group who wanted to move here because they were excited about meeting different people from different places and seeing new parts of the world and learning new things. And I think over time, those genetic sort of groups have stuck with each other. And we're seeing the culmination of that now in our culture.
Yeah.
So that is the one thing I think that defines the difference. But when it comes down to it, everybody does want to get along. Everybody wants to be liked. Everybody wants to feel love in their family and be safe. And so those things really don't separate us.
No, but they don't. Mm-hmm. It really is about the level of fear. I think it was George Lakoff that I was reading that did a really big study on liberal children upbringing versus, you know, conservative children upbringing. The difference, some of them being like just a sense of an authority figure so that you can always just give all of your authority over to that other, to a higher power, whether that, you know, and it's typically in a patriarchal order, it'd be the father, but all that energy goes to acquiescing to that person's needs, desires, demands. You know, and some of these kids turn out, you know, pretty amazing because their fathers have really extreme demands and push these kids to different levels. However, you know, you will see that many times there's a backlash that they have to go find themselves afterwards, after being somebody else's, you know, minion, so to speak. They have to find themselves to get authority back for themselves. And that's a scary trip to get your own voice back after giving it away. So what most do is they go look for the next one. Where's my Jim Jones?
You know,
where's my next daddy? Where's my next authority figure? Well, who's going to give me the box to live in?
Yeah, it seems like left side politics and orientation is not as driven by an authoritarian figure head. They're more prone to problems with groupthink. The right-leaning does like to tend to have a sort of more fascist orientation where there's a single leader who is not questioned. And so we did see that with the Trump presidency. He very much did not tolerate dissent, and he selected his cabinet based on who was going to be, you know, willing to do whatever he said, basically. But that's something that's very comfortable for, I think, that side of the spectrum, because they do feel like having a strong leader who rules with a kind of an iron fist keeps things in order and keeps things predictable. Whereas on the left side, I think we tend to value discourse a little bit more and comparison of ideas. But again, that can kind of morph into this thing where, especially we see in the universities, where open dissent of that main viewpoint is not going to be encouraged as well, that there's going to be a shutting down of alternative opinions, to the point where I think a lot of university professors now are quite scared of their students, and it's hurting academia.
Yeah, everybody's got, you know, their truth. And there seems to be a lack of humility around what is truth in terms of like, what is my truth and my ability to shout it from the rooftops because it's mine, even though it and not be able to listen to anybody else's truth, because that might disturb your truth.
Yeah.
You know, the shouting over ideas, because you've got the one idea that's real, and it's not always that case. Very seldom is it. Well, as I've gotten older, it never is the case. Mm-hmm. There never is a complete and total understanding of almost anything.
Mm-hmm. Truth is shifting always, right? In a sense. And then it actually brings me back to a Philip K. Dick quote. He said something like, reality is that which, when you stop believing in it, doesn't go away.
Yeah. Yeah. When I stop believing in gravity and I jump off the roof, guess what? Gravity
still there.
Brings me back to a truth.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And one could say that there probably are philosophical or ethical truths that remain throughout generations that are unchanging. But it could probably just as easily be boiled down to what we've all called the golden rule, like treat others as you would wish to be treated. Although I like to change that one now to treat others as they wish to be treated.
it's definitely more effective. The platinum rule.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The platinum rule. I like that. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So gratitude is like another thing, like just going at life with an appreciation for all that is around you. Really kind of shifts your game from that fear state where mm-hmm. you're like afraid of everything to a place where you're more accepting even of the challenges mm-hmm. that you go, yeah, I get that challenge is not easy, but I know that I need to go through that. I'm mm-hmm. grateful for the opportunity to learn, mm-hmm. you know?
Yeah, we can't learn without some suffering. We can't grow without pain. And so the more we protect ourselves from perceived pain, the less we're going to grow. I use this analogy frequently in psychotherapy sessions that inside of us is always a seed that needs to grow into fruition. It needs to become what it's supposed to be, whether that is a dandelion or a tree. Mm-hmm. But all seeds are going to have to fight past the earth. They're going to be fighting through darkness, unsure of what they're going to become, sometimes running into pebbles and rocks and things, and they got to get around that to reach the sunlight. And then once they come to light, which I think is a good metaphor for awareness of who you might become, then that growth continues. And it's always changing. Even a tree is going to be growing once it becomes its tree-ness, right? But I think all growth requires some degree of pain and suffering. So yeah, avoiding that leads to stagnation.
So yeah, I'm in these groups where they talk about transition and transitioning and transforming lives. And mm-hmm. and one of the things they talk about a lot is just going through it. You know, you can't get to a thing. In most of life, you've got to go through it. There's a journey, there's a path, there's the shadow that's right there, and you can keep ignoring it, or you can go in and go, let's have a conversation. Mm-hmm. Why do you have so much energy here? Mm-hmm. What's going on? What's happening? Mm-hmm. You know, getting down to these parts of ourselves. And I do find that if I am having like a stressful time, overworking an idea, something that's kind of just cogitating up there and just spinning and not really going anywhere, I'll just go into a meditation and it'll come back, and I'll just let it go, come back, and I'll let it go. And then eventually what comes up is, you know, one of three answers is, you know, do it, like make a decision. Don't do it. Don't make a decision, or wait. So now that I know that I can find those answers, do it, don't do it, or wait, I can hang out with a lot less fear. Mm-hmm. You know, so yeah. wait just means you don't really have enough information at this point, and or the time isn't right, or something isn't right, you know. And I think intuitively we know these things, and so mm-hmm. we trust ourselves enough just to ask ourselves in a quiet space, of course, quieting all other thoughts.
What you're saying there reminds me, somehow I always bring it back to Star Wars, but it's such a great model for archetypal forces. So it reminds me of Yoda's phrase where, it's probably loosely quoted here, there is no try, there is only do or not do. Mm-hmm. And so he's teaching Luke this because Luke is impetuous, right? He wants to make the decision about what to do right away, but he says he's going to try because he's not really sure what he has to do yet. And mm-hmm. he keeps trying to impress upon Luke that he's not ready yet to face his father, Darth Vader, or, he doesn't know he's his father.
Ready to face that information.
Right. So there is this idea of if you're going to do something, commit to it. Don't just try, but don't commit until you know you're ready and you're sure about what it is you need to do. Because if we just kind of flail around in our self-development, it's not going to lead to anything fruitful. There has to be some level of determination once we've decided on a plan of action.
Yeah, that's true. And so you have to take actions, and the actions that we take on the journeys through ourselves, the ones that seem to work, involves self-care. Mm-hmm. Really actually looking at yourself and knowing what needs are not being met, what needs need to be, and then filling those needs. And then learning to love yourself again, because I think a lot of people forgot how to do that. So what does that even look like? And I think there's this fear of being a narcissist. Mm-hmm. Self-love is really the root of loving everybody else. Mm-hmm. You know, because when we get there, we're open, our hearts are open, and we're able to connect. Mm-hmm. Then the fear starts to go away. Mm-hmm. And you know, so maybe we all need to turn off TV and start loving ourselves more. But there's enough, fear drives things. It's like, I'm on this app called Clubhouse a lot. And, the massive rooms are always driven in fear, right? Top headlines, controversial subject, rooms full up. Everybody's talking over each other. Nobody can hear what's happening. A lot of fear. I'm working with a group also called the Humanity Collective. And we're working to create a space where we can deal and work with, not deal with, but work with the energies, the truths of racism, mm-hmm. and bring them out in such a way that it's educational, that it's safe, that it's informative, that people feel the freedom to share in a way that edifies the dialogue forward so that we can find more opening and more healing throughout all of us. And, my friend Darren Peters is running it out, and he's out of London. Just beautiful man. And we're building a team. And what we want to do is really have the dialogues without all the fuss and muss, without all the all the emotions, but not the selfishness, not the rudeness that we see in so many of the rooms where people start talking over each other and such.
Absolutely. Yeah, this dialogue is a demonstration of accepting what other people might believe and trying to find common threads, right? Seeking, leaning into those differences and embracing those differences, right? And that, I think, gets to the root of what love really is all about. And I'll bring it back to Mr. Fred Rogers. one of the greatest things actually was on TV. So he has a phrase about love that I like to share a lot with my patients. And again, it's going to be roughly quoted, but he says something to the lines of love. People often think of love as a perfect state of being, like joy or happiness, but love isn't any of those things. Love is a verb, like the verb to struggle, because to love somebody is to struggle to accept them as they are each and every moment. So the way I interpret that is that love is about acceptance and not judging. And it's hard to do that. Love takes effort. Love isn't something that is easy. And that's why it's a virtue. And so loving others does require, as you said, a certain amount of self-acceptance too, because if we don't accept parts about ourselves or come to terms with things we don't like about ourselves or reject about ourselves, mean, that's all shadow stuff that Carl Jung would talk about, right? If we can't acknowledge our own shadow, we can't accept our own shadow, we're going to project it onto other people and then point them out as the villain because of that. So when you talk about a narcissistic personality, they are not driven by self-love. They are actually driven by a deep feeling of inadequacy and self-loathing that they fear everybody secretly. They fear everybody also is going to notice. So their reaction to that, to puff up the ego, to make themselves appear bigger and greater and brighter and more inspiring and amazing than anybody else. And they really feed off that adoration because, again, they need adoration in order to feel any sort of sense of wholeness. And once you cut off that supply, a narcissist is very injured and can be, you know, suicidal if their narcissistic supply is cut off. So that's a person, you know, who is not loving themselves, but is really seeking that love from outside. But it's not really an acceptance of the true self, right? It's an acceptance of the image of the true self, what Jung would call the persona. So the secret, I think, to loving others does begin with accepting yourself and seeing yourself as a flawed person. Because if you can accept yourself as a flawed person who has things they got to work on, you can probably accept those things about other people too.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the key that I've found, at least for me, is the deeper I get into self-love, the closer I get in all other relationships. So that reflective quality that you talk about, you know, your shadow is going to reflect into every mirror, and every other person is a mirror in this world. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I say it like this, sometimes. So you're having an issue with someone, and when you walked into the room, they were having no issue, but now they're having an issue. So you are in play at some point in that world, whether it's just their dream reflecting on you, mm-hmm. which is typically something you've done in the past, or it's just something about you that you know, shifts them. It is you. Like, they weren't doing it before you got into the room. Right? So that's been an analogy I've been trying to use to get people to understand that you do have an effect on every situation you enter into.
Yeah. Whether you think so or not. Yeah, we have a name for that in psychotherapy. You might have heard of this before, the idea of transference and countertransference. Mm-hmm. So transference would be the projection that the patient puts on to the clinician about how they perceive that clinician based on models that they've experienced before in their lives, whether it's like a parental figure or an authority figure or like a priest type figure. There's all these different archetypal roles that a clinician can play in the patient's mind. And so that part of the relationship is something that is looked at through the psychotherapeutic process, because it tells you a lot about that person's orientation toward power. The other thing that we have is the countertransference, and that is the reactions that the therapist or clinician has to the patient. And, you know, most frequently those are described as being like the way we would see somebody that we're caring for, like a child or a student. But it can also be other types of projections, like past relationships that the therapist has had in their own romantic life or friendships. So these are not bad things. We want to recognize what the reactions are that we have to people, because our reactions often tell us a lot about our own self-work that we need to focus on, which is why, you know, I'm a big believer that stress is not caused by the things that happen to you. Stress is caused by the way you interpret the things that happen to you. And that includes interactions with other people. Other people cannot cause my emotions to be a certain way, right? I am responsible for deciding ultimately how to react to someone else's behavior. Yeah. And that's what we talk about. We talk about boundaries. Yeah. A big buzzword these days. That's boundaries. So I'm going off a little bit of a tangent here, Gary, but it reminds me of another buzzword that goes around now, which is, I'm an empath.
Yeah.
So if I can just jump into that one really quick,
Go ahead.
Maybe not so quickly. Empathy is something that virtually all mammals, and I think birds, probably have.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a limbic system structure that we've developed to have social connectedness, right? Mm-hmm. And it involves mirror neurons. So anticipating what another person is doing and kind of experiencing that from our own perspective as well. So everybody has empathy. Well, people with antisocial personality disorder and narcissism, they struggle with empathy. I mean, I even have it, but they're a very, very small segment of the population. So most people have empathy. What I see most often in people who identify as empaths are actually people with very poor emotional boundaries that more kind of falls into this line of what we would call a borderline personality disorder, where everybody else's behavior is going to directly affect the way you feel. So there's a very unstable sense of self and sense of one's own experience. So that's dictated by what other people are doing or not doing. And that can range between extremes of like self-loathing and self-love and other loathing and other love. And so, yeah, empaths, I think, really needs to be looked at a little bit more by the broader culture and be like, hey, y'all, you know, maybe you need better boundaries with people and just accept yourself a little bit more as having these differences so you don't have to rely on other people's feelings. But it is something that people experience. I've just noticed that as like a big cultural phenomena is describing oneself.
Yeah, that way. Yeah. I heard the word coming up a lot. In Clubhouse, there are a lot of people who describe themselves as empath, which find is there's been a lot of abuse with most of those folks. That
there you go,
and that mm-hmm. they have a very heightened sense of what other people are feeling, because going back to self-protection, knowing what other people were feeling would give you insight into where you need to move yourself next.
Yeah, I think that's a really, really important part to mention. I appreciate that, Gary, is that I think trauma, interpersonal trauma, does inform the orientation of the empath, because there's a lot of anticipation and hyper-awareness, yeah. hyper-vigilance about what other people are thinking and feeling, because it might actually directly affect you as it would if you were raised in a traumatic environment as a kid.
Yeah.
So yeah, and the parents who inflict that type of damage to a child have zero personal boundaries, because the child is simply an extension of their ego. And so, you know, they're entitled to make the child feel whatever it is the child feels that is negative in their own mind. So yeah, I think you're right. I think that's a much more sympathetic look than I was initially taking.
Well, no, I do get the badge. It's something that's stated a lot, and I think people are just saying, hey, look, I feel things, and it sounds like people are listening now. Mm-hmm. And so this is an accepted term, you know. And I don't know that it actually, I mean, it's one of those words that gets cloaked into a lot of other ideas, I believe, also. Mm-hmm. So that's where it also starts to get this validity issue. It's like, okay, what are you actually saying here?
Yeah. What's the phenomenology of this thing?
Mm-hmm. What are you saying when you say you are?
Mm-hmm.
What does that exactly mean? Mm-hmm. And typically what I've noticed is that they're highly sensitive of other people's emotions, and they tend to take them on as their own.
Mm-hmm. There's a codependency there.
Yeah.
In the meaning of codependency, there would be like feeling responsible for other people's feelings and deriving your self-worth from caring for others who have a problem, which is what we see a lot in kids who are raised by alcoholic parents, because they're always having to anticipate what the alcoholic parent might need or what they might do or, you know, problems they might run into. And so they develop a pattern relationship often where they are involved with people who constantly need them to take care of them. And that's codependency, as far as I understand it. So I think, yeah, that's a big part of feeling like an empath. So when I work with people who describe themselves that way, I give them kind of this basic rundown like I have with you, and I describe it as like, well, an empath is something that we can all feel at some point in our lives. And what that is telling us is that we want to try to move closer to the realm of empathy, which is recognizing what other people think and feel and valuing that and trying to experience it through their eyes, not your own, but doing so in a way where, like, if we have two overlapping circles that represent each person, there's not, it looks more like this, like a Venn diagram, rather than a circle completely on top of the other, so there's no sense of self anymore. Because all relationships would look like that overlap of circles, where there's a little bit in the middle, and that little bit in the middle of a shared circle is the relationship. But there ceases to be a relationship if those circles are completely overlapped with each other or subsumed in one another. And that's what we call enmeshment.
Right, right. Yeah. So this enmeshment is denial of one's self and authority for somebody else's self and authority.
Mm-hmm.
It's common.
Mm-hmm.
And it's almost required systemically.
Well, there's certain developmental periods where it's appropriate. So a mother or a father and child, or a parent and child, it's got to be enmeshed because that child is completely dependent on that parent up to a certain point. And so, you know, developmentally, we see the relationship of parent and child move from overlap circles to eventually more of that Venn diagram appearance where there's that shared portion. But during adolescence, we could even argue that those circles come completely detached from one another and they don't recognize you. Who are you? You're an alien
right.
to me.
Oh, they're no feeling empathy. That way. Don't you care right. about your mother?
You right. Know? No, I yeah. hate you, you know? Yeah. But that's kind of a necessary part of development too, is to establish, well, like, who am I in comparison to you?
Right.
Right. But eventually they come back together, hopefully, if the relationship's not destroyed through the process. And there is an understanding that we share something here.
Yeah.
And I think romantic relationships often start with a little bit of enmeshment as well. There's a little bit of defining oneself and the other. And relationships that stay that way tend to have a lot of codependency problems, but most aren't like that. Most move to that more Venn diagram appearance. And when we break up with somebody or have a divorce, you know, that is the circle separating.
Yeah.
And that's a very painful feeling. That's why divorce and breakups are one of the biggest causes for health problems and suicide.
Yeah, yeah, that's a heavy subject.
Mm-hmm.
It does. It, you know, I went through. Well, I grew up. My mom went through several marriages. So,
mm-hmm.
You know, you go through several different families, really,
mm-hmm.
and it's an interesting thing. But yeah, every time there was a break, then I don't know. There's a freedom with it, though. You get to be your own circle.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But but that loneliness, especially if you don't love yourself, you know, then you're just, that's way out in the cold, man. That's no fun at all.
Like a planet being thrown away from the solar system or something, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So loving yourself is super important. Do you find that that's where you're trying to take people back to as your primary goal?
Yeah, and I take the model of what Carl Jung would call the process of individuation.
Mm-hmm.
So in that process, it's a very artful combination of supporting the greatest parts of that person and helping them to develop their strengths and appreciate the things that they genuinely have talent in, and also balancing that sort of championing of self with recognizing their faults and the dark parts of their personality and the mistakes that they've made and taking accountability for those things. Because if we can accept, being the word here, all the parts about ourselves, then we no longer have aspects of our psyche that are in conflict. And that conflict is what causes the depression, the anxiety, you know, the dissociation, and the problematic patterns of behavior. So if we can bring all those things into view and accept them, then we become whole rather than having these fragmented parts of self floating out there. So that is the process of psychotherapy, you know, most often, although there are some cases that I have where that's not really the focus necessarily because there's more immediate needs.
Yeah.
But if somebody is with me long-term, that's usually the work that we end up doing is like, all right, let's pick up all the pieces of who you are and put them back together again so that you can love yourself and have an effective life.
Mm-hmm.
And that looks different for each person.
That deconstruction and then reconstruction, basically mm-hmm. is, you know, it's been done through talk therapy for a little over a century, probably really longer than that, ever since there's been fires, you know, and people have been sitting around them. But now we're looking at, and I guess even since there have been fires, then they've been looking at psychedelics in in medicine. Now, I know you're not allowed to prescribe, but I imagine that you've probably looked at some of the research on the use of, say, ayahuasca and mushrooms in particular for doing just what you're talking about, which is that whole deconstructing of the psyche and bringing one into a reconciliation with their actual self.
Yes, I have been keeping up on quite a bit of that research. There's, you know, a big zeitgeist right now in Oregon and Washington, California, primarily for, you know, having some sort of a program for how to do psychedelic therapy. I have several colleagues who are directly involved in that. So most of the research I've read is involved with psilocybin. I haven't noticed any research about ayahuasca. I think that tends to be more anecdotal research that people do, we call clandestinely, outside of like peer-reviewed literature, but I might be wrong about that. But with psilocybin, the things that I've read most about are treating conditions like depression, particularly with end-of-life scenarios where a person has a terminal illness. And then also disorders like obsessive compulsive disorder and other types of anxiety disorders. I think I've read some stuff about PTSD. So what we know about psychedelics is they break out of what's called the default system of neural communication. So the default system is the way our brain normally communicates with different regions of itself. And that constructs our sense of who we are, what our environment looks like, the boundaries between us and our environment, what those look like. And they stay relatively stable throughout most of our life. When we take a psychedelic, it helps the brain start to branch out from those old tracks and develop new connections that it's never made before, which is, you know, a way to explain why a person has synesthesia experiences with hallucinogens. So smelling colors, tasting sounds, things like that, because now you have those regions of the brain that are responsible for those cognitions talking to each other and be like, well, I don't know, what data have you got? Well, this is the data I got. Oh, wow, that's interesting. This is a new feeling. And so along that process, a person is able to deconstruct the assumptions they've made about themselves and others and their place and their relationships. And it's kind of like taking the deck of cards and tossing them in the air, and then they naturally kind of fall back into a new stack. And the stack is essentially more cohesive now because it's had a chance to kind of compare all of the different cards to each other. It's a hard way to explain, but basically allows us to break out of that default network, shuffle up the information, and then come back to a new understanding. And so for a lot of people, it's described as something akin to a religious experience or a spiritual awakening or a light bulb moment. So it is very much a powerful tool. And actually, I think that those of us who are supporting the idea of psychedelic therapy now are a little bit miffed with Timothy Leary because he took this very important medicine and kind of championed it to all of society to take as a recreational activity without supervision or meaning, and he didn't give them any sort of, you know, like net to fall back on once their world was deconstructed. It was just kind of like, all right, here's some dynamite, go and play with it. Yeah. And so I think there was a lot of destruction from that. And it also really harmed the medical view of what those things could actually accomplish. And we've been fighting back for that ever since. Now, Tim DeLeary had a lot of great things he did too. He's a fantastic psychologist in a lot of ways, but that is one thing I think that people are still trying to put back together after his influence. So now, you know, the thing that I would stress about psychedelics is if you're taking them recreationally, you're probably not getting the most out of what they can actually offer you. And so the control environment that they do in those therapy sessions is really quite interesting. rather than it being like, you know, a walk in the park and looking at the trees, breathing and whatever, you know, seeing colors and kaleidoscopes outside of you. And what they have is the patient lies down on a couch or a bed, and they wear sensory deprivation equipment. So they have blindfold on and noise canceling earphones on their ears, so they can't hear or see anything. And this way, they're completely redirected to the inner experience of what's happening psychedelically. And every now and then they'll like take off the blindfold and earphones and they'll say something to the therapist. So I'm really struggling with this idea of this third feeling. And the therapist's job is to help support that insight, and then as quickly as they can, redirect them back to that internal dialogue, that internal experience. So they spend, 4 or 5 hours, you know, just inside themselves, you know, exploring their mind, which is, I think, far more beneficial than, say, taking mushrooms and going to a rave. I mean, there's a lot of great experiences to be had, synesthesia, you know, all the different sensory stuff that a person feels. You know, it's very exhilarating and it has its own benefits, but it really pales in comparison to this like deep dive into the self that's in this more controlled environment. The other part about that controlled environment is if the person has a bad reaction, there's somebody there to help them through that who's sober. I wouldn't recommend people just, you know, go buy and eat the mushrooms and take it by themselves in their bedroom and lay down and think they're doing psychedelic therapy, because again, it's not got that controlled environment that offers that net to fall in if something goes wrong.
Yeah. Something about just human beings and feeling safe. Mm-hmm. And just that one thing, just having that one person sitting on the side of the pool, making sure you don't drown. Right.
Right.
And so you can go as deep as you want. If you know that person is there, if you don't know that person is there, you're not going to risk it.
Mm-hmm.
But you can't get out of it because you're already in, because you're already consumed. So now you're going to trip, and you're going to trip based upon what you can't control, which is your fear, you know? Mm-hmm. And then, but then again, you know, that's part of it. I mean, that would be part of it. Mm-hmm. And it is nice to have safety is so important when, especially when connecting up new brain connections.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's, it's just so important.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We were talking about like every part of new growth requires some element of danger, right? But we're talking about that there has to be some boundary to that danger. So, mm-hmm. I think it's about trying to keep those things within a safe area that growth can still take place in. So it's not too safe, right?
But yeah, I can jump off a bridge. And if I have a bungee, you know, I've got that safety, but I still get the experience.
Right. Yeah. Another analogy that comes to mind for me is like you go to the bowling alley and there's gutters on either side, right? But for beginners, you can get those little inflatable things that go all the way down the length of the gutter, right? To what they call bumpers, right? To keep the ball going where it's supposed to kind of go. And that's how I would envision something like psychedelic therapy, or really any type of therapy, which is you're trying to get the ball to go where it's supposed to go. And you don't want the person necessarily fall in that gutter, because then the process is disrupted, right?
Mm-hmm. Right, right. And it, you know, something that heavy may take a while to get back on the train. You know,
right.
Somebody trips out really hard, especially if you're dealing with something as, you know, as fragile as PTSD, mm-hmm. you know, whether it's, you know, wherever that abuse came from, but, you know, you can bring that stuff back and then it, you know, they don't finish up and then they get stuck in a moment and, you know, afraid to go back mm-hmm. and finish the job.
Right. Because they fell in the gutter, so to speak. So if you can have those bumpers, then the person gets practice on what it's like to be that bowling ball going toward the pin. So eventually they don't need the bumpers anymore. They can tolerate the idea that there might be pitfalls on either side, but they practice that path enough to where, you know, they actually hit the pins and don't go into the gutter like a pro bowler would.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You know, I realized halfway through this show that I was actually running a little hot. So hopefully it's not going to, hopefully we have enough that, you know, I can pot it down on one side, but if it's super hot, it's hard to clean, but we'll see.
Yeah. Digital distortion, right? Doesn't sound good like analog distortion.
And I just said words and you didn't hear me, but you heard me. So how did you hear me?
I don't know. I just did.
Oh.
I don't think it was my psychic powers.
Well, because I had my mic on mute. That's wild. Oh, well, this might just be the most screwed up audio ever.
Only time can tell.
That's what you do when you screw up. You just have a dance and fix things up. And you know, hopefully this will all work out and it works out. But yeah, I've been in like already three meetings today.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, you were saying like Sundays, you're like least busy day. And I don't know. I do the gratitude morning every Sunday. I go in and moderate that room with a friend. And then what did I do after that? I had another one on there that I wanted to look at. And that was the one I was sending you the information on, the men learning to love or something along those lines, which was a really an interesting topic and some amazing speakers. And then I had a meeting, a Zoom meeting with Humanity Collective. After we're done doing this today, I'll have a little bit of a break. And then I rehearse for my scene tomorrow with class.
A scene?
Yeah, I'm doing acting.
Are you in an acting class? Or?
Yeah, I'm doing very acting cool classes. And staying with a gentleman named Lynn Morshauer. He's a seasoned actor, has been around doing it for a lot of years, maybe 30 some years, maybe 40, probably 40 some years. You've seen him. He's been in The West Wing. He was in Ozark. He was Agent Pierce in 24, if you ever watched that show. Yeah, a character actor. And he's a fun guy, interesting, you know, and you get all this wisdom. Plus, there's a lot of other actors in the class who are acting. You know, they've done acting jobs all over the world. And it's really exciting. So we're doing a scene out of Get Hard. So a guy in Texas I'm doing a scene with. He's playing Kevin Hart. And I'm playing, what's that guy's name? The guy who played Elf. Can't think of his name.
Will Ferrell?
Yeah, playing Will Ferrell's part. But I'm not playing Will Ferrell. I'm playing the character. But because, you know, the idea is if I'm acting, I'm not. I mean, I could do a mimic, which is acting still, right? Mm-hmm. If you mimic somebody else, you're acting. But I like to take it, you know, look at theirs and okay, that's what they did with it. And these are the words. And where do I, what's my authentic way of approaching this? So right. Just having fun with it. And so we'll be getting together tonight at 5. Tomorrow morning we have fourth up on stage. So you do your presentation and we'll set up a scene, Zoom. So we'll have a green background, so it'll look like we're in the same place. And we'll do our scene and then we get scene notes. And, you know, it says, try this, try that. You didn't do this. You might want to try that, da, 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 da. And then you go back and try it again, and then you try it again. Or sometimes he's like, wow, that was good, one and done, and bam, they're like, well, that doesn't feel right, I didn't learn anything. Beat me up a little bit, come on, I need to know, because I know I'm not like ready for Broadway, so something went right. You know, so yeah, just having fun with that. A lot of fun. It's actually the most, I don't know, it's like the most in-depth study of anything I've ever studied. Because it's, you know, you're working with this vessel and then the projection of energy and feelings. And you're taking somebody else's words and then going to try to make those into your feelings, because their words are just the words, and it's, you're an actor because you get to feel them out and put them out there so people can go, oh my God, I feel just like that guy. Mm-hmm. Oh my gosh, I feel you, bro.
Isn't that, that's a wonderful thing about acting, is that it's the art of taking another perspective of another person as your own and doing it with such convincing means that people can feel that act, that character in themselves as well.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
It's a moment of self-recognition. And it is very much an interpretation. Like when you talk about this, I think about Shakespearean actors. Right? If everybody modeled their Hamlet off Laurence Olivier, they'd just be playing Laurence Olivier.
Right. Right.
So each person has to come up with their own version of who Hamlet is, but still the Hamletness of that character remains. And that's what the audience is like always responding to, is that undying archetype of that type of person and the struggles they're facing.
Well, Shakespeare wrote in such a way that you can take first position, which is just the words,
mm-hmm.
and give them almost zero emphasis in feeling.
Mm-hmm.
And he wrote in such a way that you can do that. And that's why Shakespeare works, is because that means a beginning actor can come in and do Shakespeare.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Even they say, well, Shakespeare's mm-hmm. hard. It is hard. It's mm-hmm. very hard. But all the words say everything, and they do all the action. They tell you everything, you know, but that's just the basics.
Mm-hmm.
And then you get Laurence Olivier, or it, even Kenneth Branagh.
Mm-hmm.
Is it Kenneth or Kevin? Kenneth, right?
Kenneth
mm-hmm. Branagh. You know, people who have gone into it again and just really, really got into Shakespeare, and then they take mm-hmm. it to a whole nother level. And that's the same thing with everything in life. You know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a Porsche does the same thing as a Ford Taurus in terms of getting you from A to Z. It's all about the honing.
Mm-hmm. Right. They both have the template of an internal combustion engine, but it's on the interpretation of that design that the differences emerge, right? And so although the script is going to be the same for every production of Hamlet, the acting crew is going to have their own various interpretations of how to perform that. And it also brings me back to the idea of classical music, which I was raised in. I was trained as a classical cellist originally, and played in symphonies and orchestras and chamber groups and all that throughout my late teen years, especially. What I loved about that art form is that everybody gets the same score from Mozart, Beethoven, Haydn, et cetera. But it's a matter of how do you interpret the feel of that score based on the notation that is in it. So not all recordings of performances of, say, the Magic Flute are going to sound the same. Some run the tempo a little hotter, others run the tempo a little slower. Some violinist is going to apply a little bit more vibrato here or more legato there based on what the notation is. So it does stay within these kind of bounds. Again, we get into this idea of like the boundaries between what we can do for self-expression. But that template is what allows us to have that individuality through it. And actually, that's something I really loved about classical music, is there's a format already made for you. It doesn't really require you to be a creative person in the sense of being a songwriter. You're a performance musician who's interpreting someone else's work as faithfully as you can with your own individuality. And rock music doesn't really offer a lot of that, because it is so much based around what the own individual's interpretation of their own music and just creating that. Of course, there's some that just transcend that model, and those are the rock musicians that we deify in a lot of ways, because it is about this individual expression, and only they could sound like them, right?
Right.
And so that is really cool. But yeah, I've just kind of, as I've progressed as a musician in my own life, I've had to bridge those two gaps in some way in my own psyche of like, how much rock and roller am I, and how much of a classical musician am I? And they're just, it's an interesting overlap there. So I think in the rock bands I played in, I most often enjoyed being support role, you know, playing bass in the band or playing rhythm guitar and fleshing out that sound for the rest of the band's benefit. That was actually where, and that's how I ended up getting into engineering recordings as well, become a recording engineer. So.
Yeah. So this classical versus new, this, what's new, what's best? I mean, Robert Pirsig asks that question, mm-hmm. you know, what's the better question? Well, what's new is all about, you know, bells and whistles, and what's best is typically a little more longer looking and well composed.
Mm-hmm.
However, you know, the what's new, if you land on the what's new that is actually the what's best when it's new, then you got something.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Those are the trendsetters, right?
Yeah, that's the trendsetter. If you find the hula hoop, right?
Mm-hmm.
And there you go. It's the thing. But that really, that hula hoop, everybody's hula hoop, I think. This is my opinion. I'm going to give you my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
Which I'm actually kind of starting to figure, it's not completely a violent act, but it's somewhat aggressive to give your opinion to anybody.
It seems that they want to hear it, right?
Yeah, unless they're, you know, sitting around. So I forgot my opinion already. That's how important it is to me. My opinion is that authenticity really being authentic to yourself is the number one goal, and that self is not a self that's ego driven. I'm talking about the self that's like the self that you ask the questions to, you know, the self that gives you the yes, no, or wait.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's, and I don't know what you call that. You know, mm-hmm. Some people call it the ghost in the machine. Some people, you know, call it whatever, but I just feel like there's a consciousness there and mm-hmm. an authenticity from which I can reflect off of that seems to work pretty well. And when we talk about reflections, it does work best when I'm still,
mm-hmm.
just like a pond. And I think that's why we meditate.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Two things that come up in mind when you talk about this. The first is Carl Jung's description of the psyche. So the parts of the psyche that most people are familiar with would probably be things like the shadow, you know, the rejected part of ourselves, the persona, the part of ourselves that we'd like everybody else to see us as.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have the anima. So for men, that would be their internalized model of the feminine. And the animus would be the female internalized model of the masculine. And then we have this really interesting part called the self. That's exactly what you're talking about, Gary. You're talking about the self, and Jung described the self as kind of like almost a theoretical construct in the way that it was really difficult to define.
Yeah.
And it may not exist entirely in most people, but it's the thing that we try to develop through individuation as a cohesive understanding of the self. And he most identified the self with being attached to that primordial essence of life that he would say was kind of part of deity, part of the divine, part of the spark that makes up every living thing. So if one is true to that initial spark that gives rise or emanates all these other parts of the self, like the persona, the shadow, and you know all this other stuff, if we can live in line with that initial spark's intentions, then there is less conflict for the other emanations of the self, of the psyche. And so, yeah, I agree. I think the more in line we are with the self, which is our source of our morals, our ethics, the standards we set for ourselves consciously or unconsciously, the more in line we live with those, the more effective we are with other people and the less suffering we cause in other people generally. I guess if you're Ted Bundy and you're really like following true to the self, well, you end up doing what Ted Bundy did. But most of us aren't like that. Most of us are built to care for ourselves and do things that aren't self-destructive. And so therefore we don't destroy other people in the process.
Right.
But I think having that focus on self is not as we mentioned earlier, it's not a narcissistic thing. It's actually the responsible thing to do to be an effective person with all the people you're around. And so the next part you mentioned was that you do this best when you're in silence, right? When
yeah.
you're at rest.
Yeah.
And it reminded me, this is probably just going to be a briefer comment, of something that's in the non-canonical Gnostic Gospels, Gospel of Thomas. And it says, I think they asked Jesus, what is the evidence of God within you? And he says, it is motion and rest. So this idea that everything is constantly moving, but then there's also moments of rest. And that is the evidence of like the sort of divine, I don't know, part of us. I don't know where that's going really, Gary, but it was something that made me think of, yeah.
It sounds like it was it's in line with laws of physics, actually, there, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
You know, all things are in motion.
Mm-hmm. And things can be at rest.
Moving,
yeah.
Well, and they're all moving towards entropy.
Right.
Which is rest.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm. Mindfulness is one of the things that I teach patients to deal with anxiety, particularly, because so much of anxiety is around what's going to happen next? What's going to happen next? I got to protect myself. And so much of depression is about what happened back then. Oh my gosh, that's awful. And so we're trapped in either the past or the future. What mindfulness allows us to do is to just be present at rest so that we can observe things non-judgmentally as they're happening at the moment. And it is something that takes practice because we evolved to protect ourselves. We evolved to anticipate danger based on the dangers that we faced in the past. So this is why humans are like so wrapped up in those two modes of thinking. But I think we perform best when we experience that flow state when we are just in the present moment. And actually, yeah. When we're in the present moment, time actually starts to feel different. It can either speed up, it can slow down, it can cease to exist. I think a lot of artists like musicians and actors, when they're in that role, when they're performing that part, they kind of lose touch with what we would normally call reality because they are completely at rest within the thing they are doing. And that's that flow state. That's being in the zone, as we call it, right? Athletes experience this too. Yeah. We can all experience it. You don't have to be an athlete or a musician. Basically, if you're just focused on whatever it is you're doing, when you're doing it, you're at rest. And in motion. It's
yeah.
Fascinating concept.
Yeah, it really is. I got to drum last week. I was in a I was at a birthday party up in Portland and a band was playing and their drummer wasn't there. So they're like, hey, we need a conga player. I'm like, I know a guy who plays conga. It happens to be sitting in this very body. So, went up there and did some conga. It was excellent. It felt good. I haven't, drummed. We haven't had any drum circles or any music really the Foxshire for a while. Mm-hmm. And, it was such a part of this household, people coming and going and music,
Mm-hmm. That's what I remember about your place. Yeah.
Yeah.
The great parties.
What was Zia's party? And I was thinking, actually, we met I met you the same day I met Zia, I think.
Is that right?
Yeah. At the Enchanted Forest.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Right.
Yeah. And you ended up running everything up to Portland, and we ended up going to our house.
Yeah.
That night, yeah.
Yeah, I had something less important to do that night, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, so that was actually the birthday party. It was Zia's birthday party last week, so.
Cool.
It was awesome. Yeah, it was at the auditorium. It was pretty cool. The Audi.
Yeah. Never had a chance to go there so far. I'd love to check it out sometime.
Well, you can actually go to a part of it every day. They're open. The wine bar.
Oh, okay.
So there's a little wine bar in there. And it's just wine and cheese and bread. I don't even know if there's cheese. Just be wine and bread. But there's, it's a little wine bar right there in Slaptown. So just under the 405 on Quimby and 16th, 18th, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So that was fun. That was fun getting back into drumming and you get into flow. Of course, when you're doing something new, there's flow, but there's also this focus, deep focus, because I had to stay. I wanted to stay in the pocket. I don't know these guys' stuff, but stay in the pocket. Listen, I've never been a drummer who led the band. I've always been a drummer who's been led by the rhythm guitarist.
Sure.
And so then sometimes I go too fast.
They start to speed up. You start to speed up.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I love playing the drums. I wouldn't consider myself a very good drummer, but it's the instrument I really enjoy the most. If there's a jam session going on, I don't want to touch the guitar or the bass. I don't want to try to figure out what to do melodically. Like, I just want to hold that beat.
Just want to pound on stuff. Yeah. It's been one of those weeks. I'm drumming. Billy, you're bass today. But I've never played. That's okay. I'll give you the bottom. It's funny. I grew up on drums, but I've never played a trap much. I've played around with them a little bit, but it's like marching band and then hand drums. And I've just kind of stayed with hand drums, but I'd love, there's a freedom of expression that I get with hand drums that I don't get with sticks.
Oh, sure.
Yeah. And I personally don't care for having that much sound hitting my ears when I'm drumming on. Like, I really need earplugs if I'm going to drum in a kit, because that's just too much going on for my head. Mm-hmm. It starts to rattle.
Oh, yeah.
You'd think that would be second nature for most musicians, right? Protect their hearing with earplugs whenever they have a session or a rehearsal. It's really surprisingly not all that common. And you can notice it sometimes, because guitarists or drummers, well, particularly guitarists who have been playing for a long, long time, they keep cranking that treble knob up on their amp thinking that they need a brighter, brighter sound. It's really because they can't hear those frequencies anymore. And everybody else is like, whoa. Yeah.
Dulled them out. Yeah. So that's, it's interesting, because I grew up where, self-care was for sissies, safety was for sissies. You don't wear, and skateboarding still has that idea maybe still more of a degree than it should, don't wear a helmet, don't wear pads, you're sissy. It's like, nah, dude, you got one brain. That's it. That's it. Protect it. Protect it. Yeah.
100%.
Protect the brain. And, but yeah, we grew up with that. Like, you don't wear gloves. You don't, I still don't wear gloves because I don't like them. Very tactile person. I have to touch stuff, even if it's gross. I don't care. Well, if it's really gross, I wear gloves, but I don't typically wear gloves. We're getting all sidetracked here. I do want to ask this one question.
Yeah.
If you could make the world a better place in any way, shape, or form, like, and you could just wave a magic wand, what would that be? What would be the one leverage fix that you'd think you'd implement, knowing that everybody else that's on this show gets to have this wish?
Wow. Wave that wand. What would I want?
Yeah.
I think, it's like, that's the type of question where I would want like a couple of days to really give you a well-reasoned response, but
just go with your gut.
Go with the gut. Yeah. I think the gut feeling that I had right then was something about the acknowledging of suffering in all things. So no longer, like, if I could wave that wand, it would look like nobody would subjugate other humans anymore. No one would harass, no one would try to marginalize. And I think they would even extend further than that. It would look like everybody acting as stewards to all the other creatures that we live with. So yeah, it probably looked like everybody going vegan and no longer torturing animals for use as food. Mm-hmm. And so I guess that would be it, is like some way to live more peacefully with each other and nurturing one another more, rather than competing and teeth gnashing and clawing at our existence with each other and trying to one up, but rather to build what humankind could be, because we are really gifted with the ability to conceptualize the abstract, which, as far as I can tell, most other mammals can't do. And who knows, maybe octopi can, but we can't talk with them very easily with the language difference. So we don't know what they're really doing. But I think that we are really kind of gifted in that regard, that we can improve the lives of other creatures. For example, like in the wild, it's very rare that you're going to see like a tortoise and a wolf being friends, right? But humans can foster these interspecies relationships in the form of like a dog, like a domestic dog. And a tortoise, like right. I saw this video just recently, like there's this tortoise and a dog playing with a soccer ball together. They're yeah. having a great old time. They're buddies, right?
Yeah.
And we see this all the time where we can foster interspecies relationships that are friendships. So when we're no longer in competition with each other for resources, then we're able to just coexist and enjoy each other's company and build our sense of self and other. So I guess, you know, that would be the wand I would wave. And I suppose what it would require is for some sort of equal distribution of resources. I don't know what that would look like.
Yeah.
Or, you know, maybe not equal, but what's that other word that we're using? Equitable?
Yeah, just a more fair and equitable spreading of a sharing of everything.
Mm-hmm. Allocating according to need, basically. Yeah.
Yeah, that opens up a whole nother set of questions about, you know, identity and self-worth and how we've built our society around these ideas of self-worth based upon what you do for society. Mm-hmm. And those questions need to be answered also and how people still prosper when this has been the identity, that work has been our identity. What is the new work? What does the new self look like in in contribution to society? And, you know, heavens knows we've got a lot of needs, like you were saying, in mental health. We've got a lot of needs in aged health. There's a lot of needs that we don't really spend a whole lot of money on. Mm-hmm. That they're spending a lot more money on other things that really are destructive in this world, you mm-hmm. know, and because they support whole societies, they continue to be industries.
Yeah.
You know, so we can turn our swords into plowshares and really make this world a better place. I agree with you. Mm-hmm. 1,000%. Love yourself. Love your others. Thank you, Duncan. This has been a fabulous conversation. Hopefully my audio doesn't take a whole lot of re-editing to get right, but I do know I was in hot earlier. Hopefully it's reconcilable.
Yeah, I really appreciate you having me on the show again, Gary. It's always great talking with you, and I'm excited to hear more of the podcasts that are coming out. And, you know, from my end, your audio is actually sounding fine. So I'm hopeful that what I'm hearing from your end is what everybody else will hear. But I guess
I am too. There was a point where I was talking and I was muted but I'm not sure what happened there because there was sound coming out. So I'm not sure what happened, but we'll see.
Well, we'll see.
Yeah, maybe because I got the Mac error that's kind of half there, which that would be weird because my mute should mute both, right? I mean, I shouldn't have my Mac Air on if I'm running through my microphone.
Guess not.
No. Well, we're digressing on the episode. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you.
A long goodbye.
We just can't say goodbye. Thank you all for showing up. Tell your friends. And later.
Later, Gary. Thanks.